Hi, Vasek.
Hi, Anand.
Great to see you.
Same here.
Today, my guest is Vasek Švatl. He was born in Prague and received his undergrad degree in mathematics there. He left Czechoslovakia in August 1968, 3 days after its Soviet-led invasion. Having earned his PhD in mathematics from the University of Waterloo in 1970, he taught mathematics, computer science, NOR at McGill, Stanford, Université de Montréal, and Rutgers. From 2004 till his retirement in 2014, he held a Canada Research Chair, first in combinatorial optimization and then in discrete mathematics at Concordia University in Montréal. His research agenda has ranged from graph theory and combinatorics to linear programming and cutting planes to analysis of algorithms to the TSP. In 2015, he shared the John von Neumann Theory Prize for seminal and profound contributions to the theoretical foundations of optimization with Jean-Bernard Lasserre. His most recent book, The Discrete Mathematical Charms of Paul Erdős, was published last August by Cambridge University Press. Vasek, you are a living legend, and it's a fantastic honor to have you here. Thank you so much.
You will make me blush. thank you for the nice introduction. I couldn't have done it better myself. and before we get properly started, I want to thank you for Subject 2, for the program. It's a wonderful initiative, and thank you for the idea, thank you for the implementation. I have already listened to a few of the interviews, appreciate them very much. I am looking forward to listening to all of them.
Wow, thank you so much. That means a lot to me. Thank you, Vasek. So most people know you as Vasek, but your first name is actually Václav.
It's Václav is in my passport. Vasek is what my friends call me. It's a bit like Václav is like William, and Vasek is like Bill.
Yeah. So you prefer to be called Vasek?
Yeah. Yes.
Well, so how did your magical mystery tour started?
Well, which magic mystery tour do you mean?
I mean, where you were born and how did it evolve?
I was born in Prague. I stayed there the first 3 years of my life. Around that time, the communists took over the government, and a few days before the putsch, my father gave an anti-communist harangue speech, which earned him being kicked out of his job at the ministry, and we moved to Plzeň, which is a smaller town. Smaller town is a big brewery and big heavy industry.
Right. So what was the occupation of your parents?
My father was a lawyer and my mother was a school teacher, elementary school.
Right. Was math your first choice as a degree?
Not really. I was fascinated by the periodic table of elements when I was around 17, 18. I wanted to study chemistry for that reason. Then shortly before, I already got accepted in chemistry. And then I talked with another student who told me that I was an idiot. If I wanted to study the periodic table, I had to go to theoretical physics. So at the last moment, I switched to mathematics and physics, and then I ended up with mathematics.
Okay. What about film school? I thought you had some interest in that.
That's what I was thinking about. That's what I really wanted to do. I didn't want to do mathematics, but of course my parents wanted me to, as many parents, wanted me to have a safe employment with a pension, so which you don't have if you are a filmmaker, typically. So I thought, well, I would finish mathematics to make parents happy, and then I would switch to film. So, but then the Russians came,
Yeah.
and that was it for the film school.
Did you admire any particular film director?
Well, at that time, Jean-Luc Godard very much, Pierre Le Fou, Breathless. Yeah, and there were very good film directors in Prague. Forman was just beginning, and Chytilová was, well, other people. Right.
Okay. You were 18 when you joined university, and that is quite standard. But you published your first paper at the age of 19, and that is not normal at all. What is the article about?
Well, the article is about rigid drafts, and it came about because at the end of my first semester, the man who taught, the professor who taught Aristoteles, his name was Hedelin, he took me aside and said they want to do research with him. And I was bowled over by the suggestion. I said, of course. And he gave me a problem to work on. I solved it. And then he said, I should write it up. So, of course, I thought that I would write it up and he would put his name on it. And he said, no, it's you, it's your work. You should, it will, your name only will go on it. So I wrote it up. My English was not really up to scratch then, but I had an old book by G.H. Hardy. So I dove for the book and just copied phrases from it. I mean, adapted them to my own purposes, but essentially the phrases were this old style English from 1920s, 1930s. Hedelin, my guru, was very much impressed by my archaic English. And that's it. And he submitted it for me for publication, and that was my first paper.
Yeah, fantastic. G.H. Hardy is was the mentor of Ramanujan,
That's
the
right.
famous Indian mathematician.
That's
Yeah.
right.
So you had important classmates like Pavel Hell, for example, and a great tutor, as you mentioned. So I suppose you had an interesting time there in the mid-60s, mid to late-60s in Prague. And the first meeting you had with Boerdos was around 1965, and it went under unusual circumstances.
Yeah, that was another wonderful thing that Hadrian did for me. He arranged for me to present myself to Erdős during the time when he was visiting the Academy of Sciences in Bratislava, the Slovak Academy of Sciences. Actually, I don't know if I should tell you all the details. They are in my book.
Okay,
So
you
if
can tell
I
the highlights.
let I can tell you the page number and people can buy the book and anyway. So incredible stroke of luck. There was a scheduling screw up at the academy. Just at the time Adele was coming, there was an important meeting that everybody had to be present at. So one of the people from the academy asked me if I would please play host to Erdős for the time he was going to be there, which was 3 days, 3 days and a half maybe. So I said yes, of course, and I had Erdős all to myself, and we had a limousine, government limousine with a chauffeur at our disposal. I would every morning the limousine would take me from a student dormitory where I stayed to this wonderful opulent hotel where Erdős stayed. I would have breakfast with Erdős. And once we took the limousine and went to the town where Erdős's mother was born. Now, and it was wonderful, and he just showered me with theorems and conjectures and problems, and was very, very kind to me, very understanding, very tolerant. I bought my English, which was very bad then.
Mm-hmm. Wow. You were only 19.
At the time, yes.
That must have been a fantastic experience.
It was, well, maybe 20.
Yeah, okay.
Maybe 20, yeah.
Right. You graduated in 1968, and you originally still had the plan of joining the film school, but the Russian invasion forced you to change plans.
Right. So I went to Vienna with the border between Czechoslovakia and Austria was the only border to the west, which was open then. In Vienna, a wonderful man, a graphurist, Herbert Izbitsky, at IBM Vienna took care of me. I mean, I went to IBM Vienna, and at the time I thought foolishly that mathematical papers are a bit like newspaper articles, right? You write them, publish them, and get paid for them. So I had two unpublished manuscripts with me. I went to show them to Izbitsky and asked him what did he think, which I told him I need the money, so which journal would he recommend that I should send it to, which of them pays the best, the most? Well, he disabused me of this fantasy, but wrote many, many letters to different universities asking if they would have a graduate fellowship for me. And as he was preparing those letters, he said, well, do you know anybody, is there anybody who could give you a recommendation? I said, well, I don't know, I know Erdős. And he laughed and he said, of course you know Erdős, everybody knows Erdős. But the question is, does Erdős know you? And luckily I had with me a postcard that Erdős sent me. I brought it with me as a sentimental souvenir. Mm-hmm. And it was a typical Erdős postcard, right? Mm-hmm. My mother plus I are here for a few days. And I hope your work is progressing well. And how many subsets can you pick out of set of an element such that blah, 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 blah. So, and when Izbitsky took a look at the card, as a postcard, he just did a double take. And his eyes went like this, and he made 200 copies of the postcard and attached it to every letter he sent out on my behalf. So that helped.
Wow.
Very much.
Yeah, incredible. How did you manage to survive in Vienna?
I washed dishes. It was a very nice job washing dishes in a hospital. It was a big hospital with a big kitchen. I thought, until that time, I thought that the hospital personnel always eats things which the clients, which the patients don't eat. That they wait till they eat the rest, the scraps, so to speak. And that's wrong. I mean, we ate first and the patients ate what was left over. Mm-hmm. So we ate well and we were paid well. So I was married at the time. I was there with my first wife. And so we are paid so well that after 6 weeks we paid our airplane tickets to Canada and went off to graduate school.
Yeah, you had a little help from your sister-in-law?
Yeah. My sister-in-law was in Fredericton, New Brunswick then. It's not the New Brunswick, New Jersey, it's a maritime Canadian province on the East Coast. And she went to the chairman of the department and explained the situation to him, and he had us over. I went to graduate school, my wife went to undergraduate.
Yeah. After some time, you went to Waterloo and you met a couple of important names there, in particular Crispin Nash Williams and Jack Edmonds. How did they influence your work from that point onward?
Well, Crispin was a wonderful advisor to me. He pretty much gave me a free rein, whatever I wanted to do. So I wrote my thesis on subjects that he wasn't interested in himself, but he kindly supervised it. After I wrote my PhD, I thought, well, Crispin was interested in Hamilton and Drazen. And through a combination of circumstances, one was Crispin's interest, another one was a wonderful lecture by Erdős. Again, I describe all this in chapter 11 of my book. So, but because of this, I got interested in Hamilton cycles, proved the theorem, that eventually got me a job at McGill and at Stanford. So that was Crispin's influence. Jack would give me private one-on-one tutorials in his office, explain his work, explain linear programming to me, explain its role in combinatorics. And that was very important to me. That eventually led to my paper on what's called Gomori-Hwata cutting planes.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Wow. By the way, my dad was also doing PhD in chemistry in Waterloo exactly at the same time. And maybe you crossed paths at some point.
Well, we didn't hang out with chemists so much.
But it took 5 years for my father to finish his PhD in 1971, while it took only a year for you to complete yours, right?
Well, it's an optical illusion that year. It was really 2 years. In Waterloo, they counted 1 year that I did in New Brunswick towards the two-year requirement. So,
again, to join Waterloo, you had a little help from Paul Erdős.
I went there because Erdős left a recommendation for me there. He left a recommendation with Nash Williams, who wrote to me to New Brunswick. So I went to the department chairman and said I was much grateful for having been received by him so nicely, but now I would like to go to Waterloo. And he got upset. He said that was unethical. And who was this man anyway? I don't know if he was wondering who Erdős was or who Nash Williams was. I don't remember, but anyway.
Yeah. So after completing your PhD, you started a postdoc there in Waterloo.
That's right. And during the postdoc year, like many postdocs do, I applied to different places for a job. And eventually I got 3 offers, of which 2 I accepted. I was very glad to receive. One was at McGill, one was at Stanford. By that time, I was very much interested in Montreal, so I didn't know what to do. I decided to take the first semester at McGill, second semester at Stanford. And in a way, that was my undoing, because the first semester, I fell in love with Montreal. And
Right. And you found time to write a prize-winning short story called Deja Vu. Tell me about it.
I met a couple of girls in Quebec City where I was at a mathematical sort of gathering.
You were divorced, by the way, right?
I wasn't divorced, but I was not with my wife anymore. Ran away, but officially I was still married.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so I told them that I wanted to write a book. I had this plan of writing a book called Deja Vu.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, I absolutely have to put a chapter in the book about them. I said, yes, 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 I will. And then I realized that I probably will never write the book. but I didn't want to disappoint them too much, so I just wrote a story. I wrote only the chapter, if you wish, and sent it away. It got published, to my great delight. And then about 2 years later, a friend of mine who was very cultured came to me, a mathematician, came to me and said, you know that your story was put on the list of best short stories of the year. Oof. Well, I was glad.
Wow. What a turn of events from mathematics to writing short story. Yeah. So we're talking about the late 60s and early 70s. And I wonder how much you were influenced by the hippie movement.
Well, I was a part of it, pretty much. I mean, I never lived in a commune, but I had friends who did. And I had very long hair. I would paint my face and I would hang out with wherever the hippies hung out, and
yeah, you were in your mid-20s,
yeah,
right, and so you're 100% influenced by the movement.
Yeah, well, 100%. I know if I was also influenced by other things, so I wouldn't say 100%, but
okay,
I was influenced by reading.
So you were into sex, drugs, rock and roll, and math, not necessarily in disorder.
Yeah, that's right. Nothing to add to it.
Yeah, I noticed that you were a Beatles fan, just like me, as can be seen by the cover of your new book, which is a clear reference to the album cover of Let It Be. Uh-huh. Also, there is a direct reference to the song The Night Before in your short story.
That's right.
I saw that too. So that being said, that iconic photo of yours in which you were dressed as a sergeant had anything to do with Sergeant Pepper's?
Well, I mean, the photo, Adrian Bondi, who took it, and I refer to it as a Sergeant Pepper photo. I got that uniform in a boutique, which it reminded me of Sergeant Pepper. And so it had to be mine. So I bought it. Adrian took my picture. That's it.
And you went to a conference dressed as a sergeant.
In Atlantic City, there was an ORSA meeting in Atlantic City. And everybody else was there in the IBM uniform, pretty much. And I was there in my Sergeant Pepper uniform.
That's amazing. You're certainly a very reverent person. Have you got into trouble in your professional or even personal life because of that?
Oh, not really. I mean, I got arrested on the Mexican border for trying to... Well, I got arrested. That's a long story. I don't know if you want to hear that, but... I think what you alluded to is when I was at Stanford, they had it was not quite distance teaching, but in a way it was. They had students at Lawrence Livermore Laboratories across the bay, and they had a closed circuit hookup, closed circuit TV, so that I taught in a classroom which had a camera. It had a camera taking my pictures, taking pictures of the pad I was writing at. The people who did it had great fun, the technicians had a great fun with it. So anyway, so I was being listened to by people in Lawrence Livermore Laboratories, and one of them was then talking to David Avis, a friend of mine, then a student of mine, but then a friend and student of mine. Not knowing, not realizing that David was my student, he said to him, you know, the standards at Stanford are really plummeting. He said, did you see that creature who is teaching linear programming? He didn't tell him that the creature was his advisor, but...
Yeah, that's a good one. But did you get arrested at some point?
Oh yeah, right. Well, it was like this. I went to with my girlfriend. I went to Mexico just a little bit across the border. Right. I think it was Mexicali, the border town. And then I wanted to go back. And they wouldn't let me in the US because I didn't have the right kind of visa. I forgot to extend my visa. Right. So I said, fine, I will. They said, but you can get them extended in the US consulate in Mexicali or in Nogales, I don't remember. And I said, fine. So I went there and spent the night with Marie, with my girlfriend, in a motel. Then I went to the consulate and asked to have the visa extended, and they said fine, they would let me wait and wait and wait. And I was without breakfast, I was getting hungrier, hungrier. Eventually I said to the woman in charge, I said, listen, I haven't had any breakfast. Could I do you mind? I will just go across the street and get something to eat. And she said, well, wait for the immigration officer. He may give you a permission to eat. And I got pissed off, permission to eat. So I thought, permission to eat. So I got up with took Marie and went across the street to a restaurant, ordered a wonderful meal. No. And then just as they were putting the plate in front of me, it was like a scene from a Western. They had those low door, swinging door to the bar, and the door was kicked in. Five Mexican policemen rushed in with bayonets and stopped in front of me, pointing the bayonets at me. It turned out that by crossing the street, I entered Mexico, which I didn't realize. I entered Mexico illegally. Illegally, so they grabbed me, didn't let me eat even a single shrimp, and took me away to a police station. And all this time, one of the Mexican cops was saying to me, "So you want to go to Yale?" And of course, the usual, the Hispano forms, opponents. He meant jail, but he kept saying, "So you want to go to Yale?" And I didn't understand what's going on. So I said, "Not Yale, Stanford." He said, "Don't you want to go to Yale?" I said, "No, Stanford." And yeah, so eventually they let me go. I spent maybe 5 hours in the Yale, and then they let me go. Yeah.
That's fantastic. Was around that time you wrote your first paper with Paul Erdős?
That was before that. That was while I was getting my job interviews. So before my job interview at Stanford, I passed through a small place in, was it state of Washington State, where there was a number theory conference. Erdős was there, that's why I went there. So just as he was leaving, Richard Guy and his wife were taking Erdős back to Calgary. He was staying with them. So just as he was on the point of leaving, I told him about a conjecture I had, and he got interested. And Guy said, or he said, I don't remember who, said, well, why don't you come with us part way? Right? I was going to Seattle, so he was on my way. Again, it's all described in chapter 11 of my book. And so Adesh, during the couple of hours or hour that we spent together in the back seat of Richard Dry's car, his wife driving, Louisa driving, Erdős proved the conjecture. And then later I wrote it up. I said in the acknowledgement, I said the authors wrote this in Professor Guy's car on the way from Pullman to Spokane, and they would like to thank Mrs. Guy for smooth driving, which I disliked very much.
Wow. In your book, you mentioned that you had an interesting meeting where each of you offered a substance to each other.
Oh yeah, that's right, that's right. That was our second paper. That was afterwards, about 6 months later, at McGill, the first semester I was there. And when Adesh came to McGill, I took him for a dinner to a nice Moroccan restaurant, wonderful, Baraka 2, it was called. Mm-hmm. Again, chapter 3 of my book. At that time, he was heavily using Ritalin. He was going through a big depression after his mother's death. But he also realized that Ritalin made him think much faster. So he could prove more theorems and more quickly than before. And at that time, I just discovered marijuana. I was crazy about it, like many people in my position. So I said to Adesh, listen, over dinner, right? Nice place, Moroccan restaurant, conducive to talking about hashish or marijuana. So I said, wouldn't you like to try some? I could give you some. He said, yeah. He said, yes. So can you do better mathematics with it? I said, well, as far as I know, in my experience, not really. He said, lost interest.
Oh.
But then he said, but, you know, if you would like to try Ritalin, that would help you in case you have a problem that you are just on the verge of solving and just need that extra little push to get you over the barrier, it would help. And I didn't have any such problems right then, so I declined. So, as I say in the book, that was the evening when each of us had a shot at pushing drugs and neither of us, both of us failed. So apparently neither of us was meant for that vocation.
Yeah, that's an incredible story. You went to Stanford in 1972 and stayed with the legendary Donald Knuth for a few days, right?
Yeah.
And what happened?
there were two people who were really very nice to me. Who brought me to operations research department was George Danzig, which I'm very glad for. And to computer science, that was Don Knuth. So he let me stay with him. He was very nice to me. He is an angelic man. And I needed to pick up my possessions from the airport in San Francisco. So Knuth's wife, Jill, lent me her van. So I went to the airport, picked up my boxes, loaded up the van, went back. I like to drive really fast in those days, went back on the Highway 101. And as I'm passing Menlo Park, I noticed that there were those clouds of smoke trailing behind me. So, you know, after all, I don't have the PhD for nothing. I put two and two together. And I realized that I had my handbrake on. I had Jill's handbrake, rather, on. So I completely ruined the handbrake. And must be said for the moral greatness of Donald Erwin Knuth that he didn't hold it against me. He still likes me.
Okay.
I don't know how I deserve this.
So they offer you a hand, and in return, you broke their handbrake.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So you have some very interesting George Danzig stories.
Well, yes. I was lucky that George Danzig took me under his wing, very much like don't know that in computer science, in the computer science department, George Dancing did similar for me in the operations research department. And George, apart from being a giant in our field, he was also a very interesting man with intelligence that didn't always follow the standard paths. And once I was leaving his house and I noticed a reproduction of an old painting, old Dutch painting, I think. I don't remember the name of the painter, but it's a famous painting of a young woman in a headscarf, smiling. And he pointed out to me, he showed me the painting. He said, "Do you see anything unusual about this?" And I said, "I don't know. I think that doesn't, I don't know." And he said, "Well, no, she is smiling, but it bothered me that she doesn't show her teeth. So I just took a white paint and I painted those teeth in." You see, I think it's an improvement. It's an improvement, obviously. So I said, "Yes, yes, much better than the original, yes." And but as the, oh yeah, when he wasn't the only one who was a bit eccentric. He told me when he started working, I think for the Defense Department or National Bureau of Standards, one of those places, he said he didn't get his paycheck for a while when he expected it. And eventually, he just thought something must have gone wrong. So he went to his secretary and said, I am a bit worried because I expected a paycheck and I don't seem to have got it yet. He said, "Oh yes, you got it," said the secretary. "You got it and I filed it already." He said, "And where did you file it?" He said, "Well, it's a paycheck, right? I filed it under the letter P, of course." So,
another one. Tell me more, please.
Story. Yeah. How he said when he first programmed the simplex method, actually, I think they programmed, they didn't have automatic computers and they just had a bunch of those desk calculators. Mm-hmm. So that one iteration took an hour. maybe not quite an hour, but so it was slow. But he, when he was ready to test the simplex method, he gave it the data for the diet problem. And he was a bit overweight then, so he wanted to lose weight. So he wanted to minimize calories. So he says to his wife, "Well, be ready around 3 o'clock. I should have the computation done, so I will call you. Whatever comes out, you please cook it for me." So Lenin called at 3:30 and said, "Listen, I don't think you should follow this particular recipe. It came out with 6 gallons of vinegar." And so that's how the idea of upper bounds on the variables came. And one, again, it shows how smart Danzig was. One of my favorite stories about him: U.S. Mail hired him as a consultant to solve a scheduling problem, which was, of course, wonderful linear programming problem, integer linear programming. And the problem was this: they collect the mail from different mailboxes, and then they bring them to sorting stations, sort them out, sort them, and then they send them on to their destinations. So the question was how to schedule those trucks, how to time them, and how to schedule them, which sorting stations should they bring the mail to, and which sources are most likely to serve which destinations, and so they expose a problem to Dunsit, and Dunsit thought about it for a while and said, well, why don't you put a guy in each of those tracks with a desk and a lamp and have him sort the letters on the way? So they paid him his fee, thanked him very much, and that was it. That was the end of the story. Now, one that's tailor-made for you, for your program, is he said once he was giving a lecture, and after the lecture, one of the listeners came to him and, listen, it was all very nice and very clear, but I still don't understand the role of those two variables S and T. He said, what? There are no variables S and T in my problem. And, the guy said, yes, there are. Listen, here it is. Minimize this objective function, S, T, the constraints. So.
Fantastic.
I thought that's how you got the idea for your program, I thought.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for sharing these stories. They are wonderful. Yeah.
Pleasure.
Fantastic. Yeah.
Pleasure.
And what's the story involving so-called Channel 36?
Oh, yeah. That had to do, as I said, the technicians who did the cross-circuit DV, they had great fun with it. They would, do split screen, or they would do my writing on the pad and my face behind it as a ghost. So, and at that time, so they were fun. And
you should find that footage, by the way.
I don't know if they kept it, but if they kept it, it would be good. Mm-hmm. The creature, right? Teaching linear programming. So at that time, there was a channel, TV channel 36 in San Jose, and station breaks for them were done by Carol Doda, the famous stripper from San Francisco. And she would say, there's those breaks, she would say in this silky voice, she would say, hello, this is Carol Doda for Channel 36. Perfect 36. And I thought that I wanted to, and because the technicians were so playful, I thought I would like to do, say, commercials, right? I wanted to bring in toilet paper and hold it, rub it against my cheek and explain to the students how smooth this toilet paper is. And then I thought an alternative idea was I asked Carol Duda if she would do a station break for me and say, hello, this is Carol Doda for Linear Programming 102. How is your entering variable? And she was for it, but then somehow she had a Channel 36 wouldn't let her.
Wow, that's surreal. What is your entering variable? I'm having so much fun.
So do I.
Okay. So up to that point, you had published many impressive results in several disciplines such as graph theory, combinatorics, not to mention your famous art gallery theorem. It was also around that time you proposed the famous Schwartow-Gomery-Katz and the Kolm inequalities, for the TSP. Do you remember how you came up with the ideas for the respective contributions?
Well, it was Jet Edmonds, right? I got completely enamored by Jet Edmonds' approach to combinatorics, his seminal work on polyhedral combinatorics. And I liked his matching polyhedron very much. So I liked He in particular, Jack has a polyhedral description of the incidence vectors of two matchings, of two factors, right, which are regular graphs of the D2. And I was interested in Hamiltonian cycles, right, which are connected regular graphs of the G2. So every inequality that proposed by and pointed out by Edmonds that's satisfied by two factors is also satisfied by the special two factors which are Hamiltonian cycles. But I thought for the special two factors, something stronger could be true. So I took Jack's inequalities and saw if I could strengthen them for the case of Hamiltonian cycles, and I could. So I was very happy about it. I called them comb inequalities because the underlying structure looked like a comb. And unfortunately, I was too stupid to rush. I just rushed too much, and instead of calmly considering what is that I proved, I want to get it published as soon as possible. And then it turned out that actually my comb inequalities could be strengthened further into facet-inducing inequalities, which was done by Martin Rötschel. And so the name is mine, but the inequalities really are Rötschel's.
Mm-hmm. And what about the Schwartow-Gomery cuts?
Well, that also came from my fascination with Jack Edmonds' work. You see, I realized that if you think of matchings, ordinary matchings in a graph, that incidence vectors as being inside the obvious polytope, whose integer points are precisely matchings, well, then the convex hull of these points you can get by taking all linear combinations of the origin inequalities, and in case you have integer coefficients on the left and a non-integer on the right, you just round down. The result will still be satisfied by the integer points. So that's what I call an elementary closure of these inequalities. Mm-hmm. Well, so Edmonds proved that the elementary closure of the obvious polytope for matchings is in fact the convex hull of all matchings. Now, matchings are really stable sets or independent sets, if you wish, in what's called line graphs, right? So I wondered if you could do a similar thing for independent sets in arbitrary graphs. And I found out soon that you cannot. I mean, that's wrong to find that out. And then I managed to prove that if you iterate the closure enough, you get the convex hull of the stable sets. Mm-hmm. And then there was just a hop and skip to proving a more general theorem, which said if you take a bounded polytope, and iterate its elementary closure many times, as many times as need be, you get the convex hull of the integer points inside. So I was very happy when I proved that theorem. I proudly showed it to Jack Edmonds. And Jack said, well, but doesn't this follow from Gomory's cutting plane algorithm? And at that time, I didn't really understand Gomory's cutting plane algorithm because it was done in terms of tableaus, and I couldn't get my mind around tableaus. I didn't know what the positive signs meant, what the negative signs meant. And I published the paper anyway. I mean, with a note that it can also be derived from Gomory's. To my great pleasure, people still liked it. Alan Hoffman liked my version. It was cleaner, and well, I don't want to blow my own horn, but anyway, it was a clean theorem without any reference to tableaus.
Right. You regret the way you presented some of the results though, right? You had the influence by Jack Edmonds, but you actually did not listen to him as you should.
I misunderstood him, yeah. You see, I mean, the prevalence assessment problem is a good example, right? I am not alone in having committed the crime with respect to these things. Many other people did, but I helped to perpetuate the wrong way of looking at things, if I may say so. You see, many people say, well, the travel assessment problem is an linear integer program problem, right? We take all the sub two inequalities, we take the degree equations, and the integer points inside that polyhedron are precisely incidence vectors of Hamiltonian cycles. Well, that's perfectly true. But it's a harmful way of looking at the travel assessment problem. And in fact, Dunsich, Patterson, Johnson themselves, who started this whole movement of cutting planes and sub two inequalities, they never described the travel assessment problem in this way. They say travel assessment problem is not the integer linear programming problem. It is a problem of minimizing a linear function over the convex hull of all Hamiltonian cycles. Right?
Mm-hmm.
You can, if you wish, you can say, fine, the convex hull, the Hamiltonian cycles are precisely integer points inside that bigger polyhedron. But why say it? It doesn't help you. It doesn't help you in solving the problem. It doesn't help you in understanding the problem. And that's what Jack Edmonds tried to explain to me, and somehow I foolishly misunderstood him. Jack has this nice notion of loco problems, which to Spanish-speaking people, or maybe Portuguese-speaking people, may sound funny. I think he did on purpose. Loco means linear objective covariance optimization.
Mm.
So it says loco problems are problems with linear objective function, which you want to minimize or maximize over a finite set, which is specified by an oracle.
Mm-hmm.
An oracle which, given any point, will tell you, does it belong to that set or not? A membership oracle, right?
Mm-hmm.
Polynomial membership oracle. And that's the right way of looking at travel assessment problem. That's the right way of looking at the matching problems. But of course, foolishly, pigheadedly, again, I like to think of matching problems as integer linear programming problems, right?
Mm-hmm.
Put down the degree equations, non-negativity, and maximize over all integer points inside the polyhedron.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, and then you see this whole notion of rank, which came out of my work, mm-hmm. or which I suggested, mm-hmm. which I introduced.
Yeah.
Well, that's fine, but it's not a rank of a combinatorial problem. It's a rank of an integer linear programming formulation of that problem,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So you might have many integer linear programming formulations of one local problem, and depending on which you pick, that formulation may have higher or lower rank, right? So,
yeah, we can associate with the famous rank one cuts, right?
Right, yeah.
Right, so, well, that's an interesting reflection. Professor Lawrence Woolsey wrote the following in his famous integer programming book. For those unfamiliar with linear programming, Danzig is the ultimate classic, and the book of Schwartl is exceptional.
Oh, that's nice of him.
What motivated you to write a book on linear programming, and how long did it take to complete?
Oh, that's very nice of Larry. Yeah. Well, I had to teach linear programming at Stanford, and I didn't like any of the books, really. One of the reasons why I didn't like any of the books was that all used tableaus, and as I said, already with Gomori, I got completely confused by the tableaus, and different people have different conventions for what a tableau means, right? Where some people put minus, other people put plus. You always have to check what they mean, and then numbers are just staring in your face and you don't know what they mean. And so when I decided to write down the system of linear equations which the tableau represents, I felt much more at ease. That was one thing I wanted, one reason why I wanted to do it my way.
Yeah, you went to dictionaries.
And later I found out that actually Saul Gass used those system of equations before, and maybe he called them dictionaries already. Mm-hmm. So maybe I called, anyway. But anyway, the notion was Gass's already. And so that was one reason. And also I like duality, because that was the mainstay of Jack's lectures to me, private lectures to me. So I wanted to explain duality my way, or Jack's way, really. Mm-hmm. So, fine. So I didn't like people who spent years writing books. So I decided that I won't fall into the trap. My girlfriend, who got me out of the medicine jail earlier, she went to see her parents over Christmas. So I just put a sleeping bag on my carpet, arranged a lamp just above my head, had the espresso machine nearby. So I would just sit. I was insomniac, uh-huh. And still am mostly. Then, so rather than fighting insomnia all night, I would just stay in my sleeping bed and write. And when I got wiped out, I would fall off, switch the light lamp off. When I woke up again, I would make more espresso and write some more. And indeed, in 10 days while Marie was away, I wrote the 10 chapters.
Wow.
Yeah. And very proudly I showed it to Victor Klee, another great man and another angel. And Vic was very nice about it. He put me in touch with the publisher, and he said to me, with W.H. Freeman, who eventually published it, or rather Peter Renz was the editor at Freeman, another wonderful man. Mm-hmm. And then Vic himself said to me, you know, but people like bigger books, because they want more subjects in the book, so that when they teach, they can pick out which of the chapters they want to cover, right? And you should also have in this and this and that. And I said, fine, but you know, to cover this and this and that, I had to first learn this and this and that. And so that took a bit of time. And then in the initial version, I didn't want the revised simplex method in. But then, fortunately, I talked to Mike Saunders and John Tomlin, but mainly Mike Saunders and Andre Perrault at Stanford, who tutored me in the revised simplex method. I realized that the way most books presented the revised simplex method, justified the revised simplex method, was totally wrong. So thanks to Mike Saunders and Andrea Perrault, I learned how to justify it correctly. So I put that in. That took time. So learning all those things took time, and eventually I think writing the book took something like 6 years. But the first draft was 10 days.
Did you expect the book to become one of the quintessential references on the topic?
No, and I don't know if it's a, well, it's nice to hear what you are saying, but no. I thought
Yeah.
it would be nice if people liked it.
Yeah, people like it, trust me. And talking about linear programming, how did you react when you learned that it was proven polynomial by Leonid Kachin, who became your friend
I
later?
thought, well, I thought, oh, I will have to rewrite the book, well, at least put in a little appendix at the last moment. So I thought it was exciting. It was very exciting, and I was glad that it came in time for me to at least put the appendix. It didn't come 2 months later. Okay.
Yeah.
Or a year later, yeah.
Yeah, and you, when he passed, you wrote a nice tribute to him, and you mentioned that he had very little space in the original paper,
Oh yeah.
in the Russian journal, right?
Yeah,
To
yeah, yeah. And you know, I think it's really funny. I say that in the in his obituary or memorial article. You know, we all like to pretend that we are the searchers, the selfless seekers of truth and beauty, right? So when somebody dares to solve a problem that we tried to solve and couldn't, right? When somebody has a temerity to be smarter than us, we don't like it, right? I mean, we should be, if we are those selfless seekers, we should be happy that progress has been made. No, when Hutchins' work came out, people kept asking each other, with always great anticipation, has anybody found a mistake yet? Right? They couldn't stand it that somebody, as I said, somebody succeeded where they failed. Right? And then, well, when it was proved beyond any doubt that Hutchins was right, well, they were disappointed. They should have been jumping up and down that, we made progress. We, as a profession, made progress.
During the 1970s, you also developed a strong friendship with Claude Bech, one of the
I did.
giants in the field of graph theory, and that friendship went beyond academic collaboration.
Oh, yeah. So, what you are alluding to is a time when Claude Bech took me to Crazy Horse Saloon, which is a wonderful striptease in Paris, where I haven't been for years, so it was a wonderful striptease. I trust it still is. And there I managed on my own to befriend one of the dancers, and then she introduced me to others, and I would hang out with a wonderful woman, the dancer there called, well, her stage name was Polly Underground. I will not reveal her real name here. And once I said to her, listen, wouldn't you like to have a paper, mathematical paper? And she said, sure. And so at the time I had a result which I think it was worth mentioning, but with no great shades. It takes half a page to describe. So I wrote it up, signed it in her name, put on her name and her affiliation, which was Crazy Horse Saloon, Avenue Georges V, Paris, and submitted with the mathematics. And Peter Hammer accepted it, but he insisted on taking the affiliation off. So.
So the note, a single page note, was published under the name Polly Underground.
Yeah, P
P
underground.
Underground, yeah,
P
right.
underground.
And also there's a reference to Polly and to Claude and other dancer in your book.
That's right. Yeah, Trucula is the one who plays a game with Claude. And Polly is the one who is interested in the diet problem. Right.
You met one Eva de Bratislava, but you did not include her finally in the book.
No, I did not, and I don't know why. There are others I didn't include, but Eva was the one who I met first. Yeah.
Yeah. So many of the stories discussed here were compiled in an excellent paper entitled Vashak Shvatal, A Very Short Introduction by David Avis, Adrian Bondy, Bill Cook, and Bruce Reed. And it was published in Graph in Combinatorics in 2007. So I highly recommend this paper to the listeners. In fact, there's another very interesting story mentioned in the paper involving the great Laszlo Lovász.
Oh, yeah. That was in 1970, I think 72, probably. Yeah. There was a long, weeks-long meeting, conference, workshop in Columbus, Ohio, organized by Rodbesh and Ray Chaudhuri. And that was the first time when people in the West really got to see who Laszlo Lovász was. So normal program was lectures in the morning, open problem sessions in the afternoon. So that was a program as it was meant to be. What really happened was that in the afternoon, Laszlo would get up and present a short proof of the main result of one of the morning lectures and a solution to one of the open problems and a counterexample to another one. So, it was like people would present, would suggest topics. And then next day, within 24 hours, Laszlo would kill them. The topics, not the people. And so people were really shocked by this. I remember Claude was walking around just, grasping his beard and saying that Lovas is inhuman, that Lovas is inhuman. So, we saw that if Lovas is going to will be allowed to continue like this, we'll all lose our jobs because we clearly have nothing to show that he cannot show. So people were quite shocked and depressed, see Claude, for instance. But Adrian and I decided to have a positive attitude. We thought we must fight the danger. We must turn, let's say, into an alcoholic so that his productivity will drop. So we had a very well thought through plan. We thought we have to get him somehow to Pizza Hut with a big pitcher of beer. So how can we get him to go to Pizza Hut with us? Well, it was clear. The way to attract him was to promise him an open problem. So we said, listen, Latsi, we have this problem that you might like to take a look at. Can we go and discuss it in Pizza Hut? He said, sure. And so we went and he got way late. Latsi got stopped on the way by somebody else who had another open problem. So Latsi said, wait for me in the Pizza Hut. I will just deal with this. So we when waited for him in Pizza Hut, we ordered just not to make it clear that we want to get him drunk, right? So we ordered a big pitcher of beer, and Laszlo was not coming. He was not coming, so we had a little sip, and then we had another glass, and then we ordered another pitcher, and when Laszlo finally came, we were a little bit drunk ourselves. So we are saying, well, no, that's it. So here is a problem. Let's see. I haven't had a beer, right? And it was clear to, let's say, also he doesn't have the PhD for nothing. It was clear to him that something funny was going on. So that plan was very well thought through, but the implementation didn't work out.
So it was a complete fail in the end.
It was a complete failure, yeah.
Yeah, so let's jump to the 80s and talk about your TSP saga, which were ultimately compiled in this great book here, which I have it. You were at Rutgers University in New Jersey at that point. And I like one particular quote of yours on the topic, which says, "The traveling salesman problem is to mathematical programming what chess is to artificial intelligence. The really useless and fiercely competitive sport that serves as a testing ground of your techniques." So tell me, how did everything start?
Right. Well, so I taught at Rutgers. I lived in New York, Manhattan. Bill Cook also lived in Manhattan at the time. And as I said, the sport is fiercely competitive. It was fun to watch. Bill and I were both amused spectators to the sport. And then one day in December, 87, there was a particularly dramatic manifestation of the competitiveness. And Bill called me up, said, would you like to go for a drink? So I did. And he described to me what happened, what transpired. We both laughed about it very much. And when we finished laughing, Bill said, "Listen, would it be nice if we got into and stirred the pot a bit and, you know, maybe show them up?" And I said, "Sure, but I would like that very much. Nothing would please me more, but it would take months and months, and I don't want to invest that time." He said, "Come on," he said, it will be 6 months in and out." And so eventually he got me into it. So I said, "Fine." So then he introduced me to David Applegate, mm-hmm. whom I didn't know at the time, but Bill Oday had been collaborating with him. And David is a wonderful man, apart from being a great programmer and good mathematician. Uh-huh. And so the three of us decided to enter the arena. Then we went to, and then a couple of months later, Bill said to me, "Listen, if we are going to work on the TSP, we better have a computer, right?" Mm-hmm. And I said, "Bill, you are so smart. I mean, I did well to join forces with you. I mean, you are so right." So we went and Bill took his American Express card and we went down to this small shop in called Tri-State Camera, it was called, I think. It was near Wall Street. And Bill whipped out his American Express card and we got the computer. The guy who brought it out from the basement, so he put the box on the table, he put it in front of us and looked at us and said, "So you guys want to solve the travel assessment problem, right?" So we thought it was magic. It was clear that we were...
It was meant to be.
Yeah, it was meant to be, yes.
Mm-hmm. Right. And at some point, you guys went to Germany, the three of you.
Yeah, well, Bernard Korte, another angel, who gave... He is a founder and leader of the Institute for Discrete Mathematics in Bonn, then called Discrete Mathematics and Operations Research. And he agreed to be our host for a year while we are working on the travel assessment problem. So we stayed there, we started working on it. And we, in those days, we thought we would solve the TSP without using the simplex method. I mean, no Ford and Patterson could for network cross problems, so why couldn't it be done for the travel assessment problem? Well, and as time progressed, we realized that there is a good that we couldn't do it without the simplest method. And this big competition was coming up, arranged in Texas. So in panic, David and I put together an implementation of the simplex method in something like 3 weeks, 3 or 5 weeks. I think 3 weeks.
By the way, you all were coding, not only David
We,
Applegate, but you and Bill Cook
yeah,
were coding, and
well, we
you
all are.
learned C, right? To
Yeah, David and Bill taught me C. I also wrote the C book, right? So I mean, I would write my version of the code, and then David would make it better.
Right.
And yeah, but
So after a couple of years in Germany, you went back, and then there was this event in Texas.
yeah, and that's when just before the event. So it may not have been just before the event. Maybe we're getting ready for it in Montreal. I don't remember. But that we, David and I, coded the simplex method in just a few weeks, that is true. I'm immensely proud of it. And sometimes it would bomb our implementation, right? Sometimes it worked. When it worked, it did well. Well, when it bombed, it didn't. And when it came to the actual competition in Texas, it didn't bomb for once. And so it seems that we did it. We saw the problem that Bill Pullbank proposed, but as a problem to be solved. So as an instance to be solved. So we solved the instance apparently faster than the other people. So New York Times wrote that we were the winning team, which I'm not quite sure with that it's correct, but I didn't complain. Right. And then we realized that, sometimes our implementation will bomb again, so we better have a good implementation of the simplex method. So we asked Bob Bixby if he would like to join us, and so now we were four, and we had a good implementation of the simplex method.
Yeah, Bob Bixby from Cplex
Yeah,
at the time.
right, yeah.
Right. What are the key ingredients that made Concord successful? Things like local cuts, strong branching, and efficient implementation of the simplex algorithm, or are they among the most important components?
Right, well, it's a mixture of things. There is not one single component which, or two single com two components which would I could I should name. It's a mixture of things. Strong branching is definitely there. Local cuts are definitely there. Other cutting plane routines, right? Some fairly primitive routines like tightening is one of them. That's a very natural idea, which is very powerful too. So, and also good heuristics for finding a near optimal tour and variations on Lincoln and Gunn. Yeah.
Strong branching eventually was incorporated into Cplex.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it was a very fruitful collaboration, right, between Cplex and the TSP solver, right? The TSP solver inspired Cplex. Cplex has helped the TSP solver.
Great. So, is it true that around that time, when you were in Germany, you met a lady in Czechoslovakia and decided to get married? You two decided to get married just after 4 weeks or so?
That's true. That's true.
Well, do you think you have made more greedy decisions? Maybe like this one?
Well,
or strong branching in your lifetime?
This was definitely not strong branching. This particular instance was definitely greedy.
But overall in your life, more greedy decisions, more strong branching?
I think more greedy.
Really?
Yeah, I don't think I went much for strong branching ever.
Right. And any regrets in life?
No, hell no.
No?
No.
Yeah. So what made you retire?
Well, what made me retire was my wife.
And you're still married to her, by the way. That's important.
Oh, yeah. And happily. Yeah. and more happily as time progresses.
Mm-hmm.
So she is a medical doctor, Margareta, mm-hmm. my wife. And she had been following me everywhere, all our life together. Wherever I wanted to go, she just dropped what she was doing, followed me. So, and then her mother had a stroke. She wanted to help her siblings to look after the mother. And so she wanted to move to Prague. And I thought it was time for once to turn the tables and I will follow her
mm-hmm.
for a change. So I went to retirement, gave up my another research chair, and went with her to Prague.
So
where I'm speaking to you from now.
Where the Magical Mystery Tour started.
Yeah. Well, yes, that's right.
Yeah. And you have a daughter, right?
Yes. Yeah, well, adoptive daughter, if you wish.
Mm-hmm.
We have her in foster care.
Uh-huh.
Right. Yesterday, she celebrated her 13th birthday with us.
Mm-hmm.
So, a prime.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, Margareta likes primes, and she
That's
tries
great.
To instill that love of primes
yeah.
in Nikki, too. So Nikki had a prime number birthday.
So, do you have any plans to write your memoirs or autobiography?
I do. But right now, you see, I'm still recovering from the marathon of writing my latest book, which we still didn't talk about. And which I want to talk about very much.
Please, go ahead. Take your
yeah,
time.
Right. Yeah. Well, here it is. Right?
Yeah.
And it was a labor of love. It's based on lecture notes that I used at Concordia in Montreal 3 or 4 times, and then in Prague a couple of times. But in Prague, after the book was written already. So those are lecture notes about Erdős's work that helped to establish the field of discrete mathematics, written for say the contestants of mathematical Olympiads. That's my ideal reader,
mm-hmm.
right? Smart, but not as yet educated students on the level of mathematical Olympiad who want to learn. So I try to make the mathematics as easy to follow as I could.
Very accessible.
Very accessible, as accessible as I could.
Mm-hmm.
I put in extra background, which I would have appreciated myself when I was at that stage learning Erdős's mathematics. And I put in a few remembrances, personal remembrances of Erdős, like those three or two or three that you brought up.
Mm-hmm.
and others. So I am, it's my pride and joy. I hope people will like it. Well, maybe I said enough.
Yeah, it's certainly a very interesting book, and I wish you a lot of success in that regard. I mean, I hope many people buy the book and get very enthusiastic about the contributions of Paul Edwards, just like you did, and how you found a very nice way to express it, right?
Thank you. I hope that they not only buy it, but also read it.
Read it, of course, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, absolutely, yeah. So, Vasek, it was fantastic to have you here. I had an excellent ride, if you will. I had a lot of fun, and I'm sure the listeners and viewers will be very, very, you know, enthusiastic and pleased to get to know you better, and to really confirm how very interesting person you are. So thank you so much for being here.
I thank you, Anand. I already told you in private, but I'm very happy, very glad that I got to know you better.
Oh, likewise. Okay, so I wish you all the best, and I'm looking forward to reading your memoirs, and please write that up. It will be very, very nice, you know, for the community and to people in general to get to know about you. Okay, Vasek, thank you. See you soon.
Thank you, Anand.
Ciao.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye. Ciao.